The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
Good day and welcome to this special podcast recording of After Kim Jong-il, a policy discussion. We would like to thank the Tongyang Group, sponsors of the Korea Society's podcast series, Samsung, sponsor of this conference facility, Hyundai, lead sponsor of the Korea Society's 55th anniversary gala in Seoul, January 31st, 2012, and the Korea Foundation, supporter of policy programs here at the Korea Society. With the passing of North Korea's Kim Jong-il, we have seen telecast images of mass grief from Pyongyang, South Korea offering sympathy to the people of North Korea and permitting the Hyundai and Kim Dae-jung families permissions to attend observances, the United States noting the passing and reiterating its desire for stability on the peninsula and its support for the ROK-US alliance, and China's Wen Jiabao, Hu Jintao, and Xi Jinping offering condolences at the North Korean embassy in Beijing. Reportage suggests a consolidation under third son Kim Jong-un, proclaimed the great successor by North Korea's state media, and Reuters is reporting a consolidation along collective leadership lines to include Kim Jong-un, his uncle Jang Song-taek, and the North Korean military under Marshal Ri Yong-ho. Reuters is also reporting that Monday's short-range missile tests were designed to signal the West to not interfere. To comment on the situation, we welcome today Ambassador Thomas Hubbard, chairman of the Korea Society, Columbia University's Professor Charles Armstrong, the Mansfield Foundation's Gordon Flake, and Harvard Belford Center's Dr. John Park. Thank you, gentlemen. We turn first to Ambassador Hubbard for his thoughts on developments.
Well, thank you, Stephen, very much for pulling together this group this morning. And as chairman of the Korea Society, I'd like to thank our other participants for joining us today and those in the audience for coming to listen to us. I had a strange sense of deja vu all over again Monday morning when I got up and realized that Kim Jong-il had died. I was one of those who was in Geneva, actually engaged in negotiations with the North Koreans in 1994 when Kim Jong-il's father, Kim Il-sung, died and actually had the experience of meeting with the North Koreans, paying respects at the North Korean mission the day that his death was announced, and of contributing in some ways to the U.S. Response to that event. A lot of people have commented in the wake of Kim Jong-il's death that this was a surprise, a surprising event. And I guess we all felt the same way when Kim Il-sung died. But I wonder if we should really be surprised. For the last 3 years, it has been clear that Kim Jong-il was seriously ill, obviously weakened by the apparent that he had suffered. And at least for the last couple of years, he has been actively promoting and developing his son Kim Jong-un as the successor. I think we all also sort of surprised when Kim Il-sung died, despite the fact that, he was, I think, 86 years old. I think we were surprised partly because it happened soon after he had received former President Jimmy Carter in Pyongyang, and at a time when we were deeply engaged in negotiating the first nuclear accord that we negotiated with the North Koreans, the agreed framework. Circumstances are, of course, different. We knew well that Kim Il-sung had been preparing Kim Jong-il to be a successor for, I think, 14 years and even before that. And of course, the time period that Kim Jong-il had been developing his son was much shorter. And of course, the son, at the age of 28, apparently, is a lot younger and a lot less experienced than Kim Jong-il was. But I don't think we should really see either of these events as surprising. But I do think we have to be worried and concerned and very attentive at a situation where the leadership of an isolated country with a failing economy and at least the beginnings of a nuclear weapons capability falls into the hands of an inexperienced neophyte who brings very little except his name into the ability to establish his legitimacy as the leader. However, I think my experience dating back to the time of Kim Il-sung's death leads me to be fairly confident that the early days of this transition will probably be smooth. When we suddenly learned that Kim Il-sung had died in Geneva, I think our delegation leader Bob Gallucci and I both thought we would go pay our respects at the North Korean mission and then walk right out. But in fact, the North Korean negotiators, Kang Suk-ju and Kim Ki-kwan, who are both incidentally still very much in government in North Korea, invited us in for coffee. Again, I thought it would be a very short protocol event, but indeed they kept us there for about 2 hours talking real substance about where we would go in the negotiations. That told me that there were preparations, there is a governmental apparatus that does those things in North Korea. And in fact, the North Koreans responded quite well to our expressions personally of condolences and the letter from President Clinton. We were back into negotiations within about 6 weeks. I think our reaction to that period was one factor that led to our successful conclusion of those negotiations. At that time, there were a lot of differences, of course. The Chinese were not really a huge factor at that time, and right now the Chinese will be a huge factor in Kim Jong-un's effort to establish himself as leader. We and the ROK were in quite different circumstances at that time. We were engaged in what was becoming a productive negotiation with the North Koreans under President Clinton. Under President Kim Il-sung, there was very little productive contact between North and South, and in fact, the South did not offer condolences of any kind on Kim Il-sung's death. And I think that was a factor in the very frosty relations that prevailed between North and South until Kim Dae-jung came into power. Against the backdrop of that previous experience, I guess I'm pleased to see both the U.S. government and the South Korean government issuing rather similar, I think very coordinated responses to this situation, expressing condolences and sympathies for the North Korean people, and I think making very clear that we're prepared to deal and proceed with our engagement with the new government in North Korea, and we hope those are productive. So I think I see a lot of downsides here. Mm-hmm. New and experienced leader will need to establish himself with the military, with all of that means in North Korea. But we were making some progress in our dialogue with the North Koreans. I think we should look at this event as offering not only downsides, but some opportunities. And as perhaps the new power structure engages in North Korea, I think we should continue to be open to ongoing discussions and to do what we can to move forward with the modest progress that we have been making. That's my introduction, Stephen.
Thank you, Tom.
Since you're in the room, perhaps it's better that you sort of control things from here, because I can't see who's talking and who's raising their hand, but I turn it back to you as moderator.
Will do. Thank you, Tom. Charles.
Yes, I'd actually like to amplify some of Ambassador Hubbard's comments a little bit, very briefly, and point out some of the ways in which the current transition puts North Korea in both a better situation and a worse situation than in 1994 when Kim Il-sung died. In some ways, the situation in 1994 was much worse for North Korea than it is now. North Korea was in the midst of a very serious confrontation with the United States over its nuclear weapons program. North Korea was entering, we now know, a severe economic crisis, which would soon tip over into a disastrous famine, starting from about 1995. Kim Il-sung's death followed shortly after the collapse of communist regimes in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union, and shortly after Sino-South Korean normalization. So North Korea appeared to be much more isolated, much less supported by its neighbors then than it does now, whereas now it has quite solid Chinese support, and is also reaching out to Russia, and that relationship seems to be improving as well. So the transition appears to be going smoothly, and the future of the transition, and indeed of the North Korean regime itself, seems less open to question than it did in the mid-1990s, and there's less talk of an imminent regime collapse now than there was then. But in some ways, and I echo some of Ambassador Hubbard's comments on this, the situation is more uncertain. The nuclear talks seem to be intractable now. There's not really, at least from where I sit, the appearance of an end in sight as there was in 1994. The economic situation, though certainly not as bad as it was in the late 90s, is still unstable. There are still requests for emergency food aid. And although the international environment immediately around North Korea and its relations with China and Russia are better now than they were then, farther afield there are political changes that must be troubling for North Korea, including the collapse of longstanding dictatorships in the Arab region. And of course, as Ambassador Hubbard pointed out, Kim Jong-un has had less time to prepare for succession than his father, Kim Jong-il, who was groomed for power for almost 20 years before Kim Il-sung's death. So my bottom line is, and I agree with Ambassador Hubbard here, the succession will proceed more or less as planned. It will go smoothly. There will be a period of mourning for the next few weeks or months, and Pyongyang will then be focused on the April 15th 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth, which has been planned for a long time, and in a way is a very convenient distraction or a point of focus following the death of Kim Jong-il. But beyond that, I think 5-6 months out and after, things appear much more uncertain. It'll be interesting to see where South-North Korea relations go after South Korea's elections next year, which may perhaps alter the direction of South Korean politics to Pyongyang's advantage. We'll see. It may be that the other external powers, Japan, the United States in particular, may be more willing to deal with the new leadership, or there may be a more positive direction in dealing with the new leadership, since some of the baggage that Kim Jong-il brought with him may be less onerous for a successor. And finally, it remains to be seen what even the composition of who is really running North Korea is, and what direction they will take the country. Thanks.
Thank you, Charles. From Washington, Gordon Flake.
Again, echoing very much of what has already been said, I think it's important for us to kind of realize that what we have seen for the last year and a half in the introduction of Kim Jong-un and his kind of anointing as a four-star general, et cetera, really represents first and foremost Kim Jong-il's planned succession process. But the actual succession itself only began the day before yesterday, because the truth is no one, even inside the North Korean system, really knows, particularly in the long term, beyond the next 1 or 2 months. And I fully agree with the previous two speakers in this regard that it should kind of go as according to plan. But the actual relationship between Kim Jong-un and Chang Sung-taek in terms of his uncle, the relationship between both of them and the military, how those things play out while Kim Jong-il is no longer in the picture is the essence of real succession. And how those things play out and how those relationships play out in the face of challenges is going to be the interesting question. And so by no means is this kind of a done deal, particularly in the medium to long term. It bears very close watching as we go forward. I think the U.S. and the ROK have struck the right tone. I mean, this is probably the best time to kind of keep relatively low profile, not to say anything provocative. At the same time, there's not an awful lot of opportunity to do any serious engagement either. We've just basically got to give North Korea its space as it goes through its period of mourning and its own internal processes. And I anticipate that there will be a period of hunkering down in Pyongyang before you go forward. There is clearly a risk factor here, and that's what I think most of the concern has come from. And that is the risk that there will be some type of a provocation or further actions on the North Korean side that is tied to the succession. And it seems to me that you can kind of break those down into three areas. One, there's a risk that North Korea, just out of its own logic and its own, program plan, will test a nuclear weapon, will test another missile, will do something further on the uranium enrichment program that really has very little to do with the succession of power, has little to do with the U.S. It's just these programs proceeding with their development as they were planned to do in the very beginning. And we could very much easily interpret those as provocations when the reality is they're just business as usual, these programs being implemented as planned. And those are something that we need to be watch out for. The second major area is obviously, North Korean actions that would be done in response to real or perceived threats or offenses from abroad. And here's where, again, while by no means advocating that the U.S. or South Korea should do anything less than they're currently doing or do anything beyond what is required to be vigilant in their own defense and security, that we need to be careful not to be providing, external stimulus to a very difficult situation. So when you've got a new leadership in there, there's a risk that Kim Jong-un and those around him will feel obliged to prove themselves to be ardent defenders of the nations. And so, there's a couple of danger points coming up in late April, early May, joint U.S.-ROK, military exercises, which, again, are normal. There's nothing new. There's nothing really objectionable on it from our perspective, but it's going to be very interesting to see how a new North Korean leadership reacts to these types of things. So perceived external threats, perceived external offenses to which they may feel obliged to respond in a stronger fashion than they would have in the past. And that would be kind of a second major area. And the third area of risk is really, one that's harder to tell, and that's kind of internal dynamics. Now, there's some indication that the events of 2010, the sinking of the Chang'an, the shelling of the Yampeng Island, were at least in part motivated by the succession process, that Kim Jong-un himself had a role in the process. And so if somehow the transition process is not going awry or is going awry, or if there is instability in one shape, form, or another that leads to factions or leads to Kim Jong-un or others himself feeling a need to distract the people from their own domestic woes or to demonstrate strength to one or another faction, and that's more difficult to predict, but it's a very real concern as we go forward. Now, my final comment would be that even though there is clearly in the short term some uncertainty and there is some risk that we should be aware of in the short term, in the long run, the passing of Kim Jong-il has to be viewed as a positive development. It was almost inconceivable to imagine that North Korea would pursue a fundamental path of reform, economically or otherwise, human rights, et cetera, that it would resolve the nuclear issue, or that we could see meaningful movement towards unification as long as Kim Jong-il was alive. Those changes would be too difficult. And it may still be impossible under his son, under Kim Jong-un. But one way or the other, we're probably one step closer to that process. I mean, the passing of Kim Jong-il is a classic example of a necessary but not a sufficient condition. But in the end, it should be viewed in a positive light. We're probably one step closer than we were before to the desired outcome.
Thank you. John Park.
Yes, I would just add with respect to the piece that is different from 1994, as Ambassador Hubbard mentioned, the role of China is something that is very critical right now. And I would approach that from two angles. One is the ongoing institution building, and now that Kim Jong-il has passed from the scene, an accelerated institution building between the Communist Party of China to the Workers' Party of Korea. And the second factor, the deepening interactions between China Incorporated and North Korea Incorporated, an extension of the political capital being invested by the CPC into the Workers' Party of Korea. I would begin by saying that as we look at the frankly, ongoing leadership succession process, Kim Jong-un has been publicly unveiled now as the great successor. So he is still not in the leadership role. But as Kim Jong-il was bouncing back from a devastating health crisis in August of 2008, we see the beginnings of this accelerated leadership succession process. And as much as we've been focusing on the internal aspects, the greater administrative post given to Kim Jong-un, the appointment of his inner circle, I think one part that hasn't been factored in as a part of this contiguous analysis is Kim Jong-il's preparation externally. And by this, I mean the interactions with the senior Communist Party officials on the Chinese side. So if we wrap this all up, I think what we see is with the unique role the Chinese are playing right now, it's too late for groups to try to establish and reach out to different groups inside of North Korea. So whichever country, whichever group has had developed those relationships, they are not in the best of situations, but certainly in the least worst situation. I think what we're seeing unfold with the Chinese side of all this in terms of very senior officials on the Chinese side paying their respects at the North Korean embassy recently in Beijing, the ongoing deepening of this institution building between the two parties. And I think that's a core element of the longer-term strategy of the Chinese to shore up stability in North Korea. North Korea is the key instability variable for the Chinese. And I think after many policy deliberations internally, the Chinese leadership came to the agreement that this institution building of the Workers' Party of Korea is the most viable and stable way to deal with this North Korean instability variable in a longer-term scenario. I would conclude with two points. One is the remarkable flexibility and creativity that has been introduced in this institution building from the perspective of Kim Jong-un himself. The Chinese leadership was adamant about not recognizing a third generation of the Kim family. And so for them, the whole notion that Kim Jong-un was being groomed for succession as a third generation, I think, was problematic. But this framing of Kim Jong-un as the rising generation of the party and also Xi Jinping as the rising generation of the party on the Chinese side, I think provides a very important conduit for further institution building. So rather than recognizing Kim Jong-un as the personal heir of the ongoing North Korean dynasty, but rather as the rising generation of the party. We'll see more and more of references to this institution building and the party-to-party interactions. The second final point is that one way, I think, to view the inner circle around Kim Jong-un, something of a cocoon, as Kim Jong-un is still maturing to this phase of actually assuming the full leadership post. What we have just witnessed, I think, one way to represent that is the passing of the sun, S-U-N, the sun, the solar energy source, to solar panels. One way to characterize the uncle, Chang Song-taek, the aunt, Kim Kyung-hee, and the senior generals in that inner circle. Now, if Kim Jong-il has passed from the scene, I think the key question is, who will be this solar energy source? Kim Jong-un clearly is too young for this, and in fact, he's the focus of more development and require more assistance. And I think the direction arrows point to different capabilities from the Chinese side, and how that manifests itself in the coming months and years, I think, will be critical. But this key question of who replaces this solar energy source is something that objectively we can track going forward. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you, John. If I could just put two questions on the table for any of our participants and speakers. One is, in terms of international response now, we've had some comments about China's critical role and China's relative to China's rise. And we've also had some mention of South Korea, U.S., Russia, Japanese, and other responses. And then secondly, in terms of the consolidation of leadership, is there a difference in terms of dealing with a collective leadership and dealing with one that is sort of single person identified, and does that make a difference?
Stephen, this is Tom. Maybe I could start answering your question by going back to a couple of things that John Park said. One of the characteristics of the Kim Jong-il regime as compared to the Kim Il-sung regime was this clear designation of the military as number one, a military first policy, and some diminution of the role of the party. Can I interpret your comments as at least holding out the possibility that the characteristic of Kim Jong-un will be kind of a restoration of the party's role, and what do you think this means for the military? Is that likely to cause some tensions?
John?
Yes, thank you very much, Ambassador Hubbard. I think one of the unique things is that point, the restoration of the party. It's a really recent phenomenon. From September 2010, we see the acceleration of the Korea Workers' Party being the front and center in terms of the interactions with the Chinese. And that's historically, that's not new. The two parties have interacted since the very founding of the North Korean state. But I think what is different now is, as you mentioned, Kim Jong-il ran the country, consolidated his power through the military. And his key title was chairman of the National Defense Commission. In the accelerated leadership succession process, Kim Jong-un was getting more and more party titles. And the interesting combination and the weaving of the two, I think, is his appointment as the vice chairman of the Central Military Commission of the Central Committee of the Korean Workers' Party. Imagine putting that on a business card. But when you look at that title, that's, I think, a very important weaving of the two sides. And under the collective leadership provides an important mechanism, at least for interim continuity with this grooming process that, was accelerated, but will be accelerated even more.
This is Gordon Flake again. If I could comment on it. I'm personally kind of wary of overemphasizing the Chinese role. It's clear that they've got the eyes on the ground. It's clear that they've got the influence. But at the same time, I'm sure that if you were ever to have kind of a real heart-to-heart discussion with the Chinese, I'm sure they're terrified that they don't have enough. And they're deeply worried that they won't be able to control the pace of events on North Korea. And in the end, all you have to note is the funeral preparations, the North Koreans made a very clear announcement that there would be no foreign delegations invited. And as far as I understand, and John can correct me if I'm wrong, that includes the Chinese and the Russians. You know, North Koreans, even at the, you know, the peak of North Korea, did everything they could, you know, not to coordinate well with the Russians and the Chinese, and the others in the Comecon nations. And so, in the end, the primary drivers here are not going to be external. They're going to be internal in terms of North Korea. And that's where the real challenges lie for the Kim Jong-un regime going forward. Again, it goes back to this basic question of expectations versus reality. Even prior to the passing of Kim Jong-il, you know, the regime was in a real tough spot. You know, you've got the 100th anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung coming place next year. You're trying to prove yourself to be a great and powerful nation, but you really got severe money problems, particularly outside of Pyongyang. You've got, you know, by all accounts, you know, some you know, returning or and increasingly serious food problems, particularly outside of Pyongyang. And so regardless of who the leadership is and whether it's an individual, whether it's a collective, there is a really difficult set of problems coming down the pike. And my guess is that the leadership in Pyongyang might be guilty of or fall into the trap of kind of believing their own propaganda. And so if you've seen just 3 days straight of people weeping and crying on TV, you might be inclined to overinterpret that to be support for the regime. But there's something fundamentally different about North Korea this time around. There's several things fundamentally different. Number one, the flow of information. Now, you've got greater penetration of information into North Korea than ever before. You've got a million now subscribers to cell phones, 20,000 North Korean refugees now living in South Korea pumping information back into North Korea, probably double that number in and out of China. So the people are very aware. They've been through an awful lot in the last decade, and there's evidence of kind of pushback. My guess is that pushback gets a lot easier after this power transition. We already saw pushback in November of the year before last with the currency reform, right, in November of 2009, that caused a change in course. So collective leadership, China's role, these are all important factors. But in the end, this is a domestic story in North Korea, and you know, no matter where you look in history, third-generation transitions are tough, and in the situation in North Korea, there's an awful lot coming down the pike, so this bears close watching.
Can I just add very briefly, I think we can encapsulate this in one way to see that from the top down, there's an attempt to take the country back. There's a real retro aspect to even the appearance of Kim Jong-un, who is very obviously deliberately made to look as much like his grandfather Kim Il-sung as possible. The resurgence of the Korean Workers' Party and so forth seems to be designed to make people look back to what are presumed now to be the good old days before Kim Jong-il took power. But on the other hand, and Gordon is right here, there is a change moving forward that's coming more from below. The existence of markets, the flow of information, and so forth make North Korean society in some ways very different than it was when Kim Jong-il took power in 1994. So I think that although the central government tries to take the country back in a certain way, I think that history will move things forward. As far as the Chinese are concerned, the North Koreans, I think, are very much chafing under the thought of excessive Chinese influence. They're not happy with the situation. It's a matter of necessity. And it will be interesting to see how the regime tries to expand its ties beyond China to try to balance China's influence with ties with other countries.
Very good. We'd like to take the opportunity to open the discussion to the floor for a few minutes. If any of our esteemed colleagues from a variety of institutions would like to, please at first identify yourself and your affiliation.
Henry Segerman, Korea International Investment Fund. First, thanks to Steve and the Korea Society for assembling such a great teleconference with such luminaries so quickly. I've been on a couple of these in the last few days.
Stephen, I can't hear. I wonder if...
I'm sorry, Henry. Could you begin again?
Thank you. Could speak a little more into the mic.
Will do.
Tom, how's that?
Better.
Okay, great. First, I'd like to thank the Korea Society and Steve for assembling such a great teleconference so quickly with so many luminaries. Been on a couple of these in the last couple of days, and this is by far state-of-the-art and very informative. One thing real fast is that Gaddafi was about Kim Jong-un's age when he took over. Of course, he had a little more experience, but I wouldn't be surprised if Kim Jong-un had a fairly substantial real power within the next 12 months. So let's just watch carefully that. Now I'd like to talk about South Korea, which we've talked mostly about China's role, but I think it's important to talk about South Korea, especially since we're in the lame duck part of the MB Lee's administration as the elections approach, and he can't be reelected, obviously. One thing that he might try is to resume the offer again No Mo Hyun's naval deal as a sort of warm-up gesture to the North. This would, if you remember, it was about 4 or 5 years ago, the very last year of No Mo Hyun's administration. He offered a deal to the North where they could essentially share the ocean near the northern limit line and defuse all of those tensions. And, you know, the deal didn't happen because of the
We lost you there. The deal didn't happen because of what?
I'm sorry, Henry. Could I just ask you to step up? And we'll use the central mic here. Just one moment, please.
Anyway, that northern limit line is the most idiotic thing. It's like the separation wall in the West Bank or the Berlin Wall, or it's some, you know, crazy geopolitical distortion. And the South might consider, and I hope that there's people listening to the podcast in the next days, might consider offering that No Mo Hyun deal again, because it could really help remove the possibility of these provocations around the northern limit line. Just a thought.
This is Gordon. I'll just chime in very briefly, and Tom and others are far more experienced than me, but as much as I appreciate that academic exercise, I would be stunned if something like that would be politically feasible, regardless of what side of the spectrum you sit on. And again, it has very little to do with the Chun'an and everything to do with the Umpyeongdo Island kind of attack, right? You know, the base and kind of South Korean politics has shifted so dramatically as a result of that. The notion that with absent any North Korean recognition of responsibility for or apology for anything related to the Umpyeongdo shelling, that any politician could kind of go back to a No Mo Hyun deal, even if you're Moon Jae-in. I don't hear anything coming out of the progressives on this front. So again, I appreciate the exercise. But politically in South Korea, I don't think that floats. I mean, given the events of the last year in particular.
Gordon, this is Tom. I agree with what you say. And one factor, of course, is we've got South Korean elections for the National Assembly coming up in April. I earlier did not really expect North Korea to be a central issue in the South Korean electoral cycle this year, but I think now it will be. I think it's hard to expect either Korea be ready to come up with major new ideas between now and the April elections in South Korea.
Hi, Josetta Capriati, Foreign Policy Association. I understand that recently China, Japan, and South Korea signed some kind of agreement. They formed some kind of association. How is that going to affect the relationship toward North Korea? Will that mean that they will act in a coordinated, with a coordinated policy toward North Korea, or each will go its own way?
John?
Sure. I believe you're referring to the secretariat that was recently established in Seoul, where the three countries will coordinate some of their activities. But the key point at this stage is that the coordination will happen more on the economic front. And so the very sensitive security issues, those are not the primary focus of the secretariat. And so when it comes to security issues related to North Korea, I don't think we'll see anything particularly strong coming out of the secretariat.
We have another question. Just a moment.
Yeah. Well, Gordon, you said lots of information do go into North Korea, but very little come up. Oh, I lost it again. But
Yeah, sorry, Steve, we're cutting out here. I can't.
Yesterday, New York Times. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead now. That's fine.
Oh, Jay Hong, I'm retired community physician. Yesterday, New York Times had an article by Victor Char. Among other things, he said this regime, you predicted the coalition of people, would not last. It cannot last more than a few weeks, a few months. I don't know what your take on that. And also he mentioned about China's role. What they may do for North Korea is one of the optional possibilities, adopt them like a little poor little kid brother and consider and treat the North Korea as one of their province. What's your take on that?
Again, John has very much addressed this in his initial remarks. I think that, you know, if you're looking at this from a South Korean perspective or from a North Korean perspective, you are deeply concerned by the level of Chinese influence. And this is particularly true in the historical perspective. You know, for all the animosity towards and between Japan and Korea in recent decades, if you take a longer, you know, point of view, you know, there's been an equal, although more difficult to be spoken, concern in terms of Chinese influence in the area. I mean, clearly, I tend to, from an American perspective, not buy into too much of the hyperbole. I don't think China wants to take over North Korea. I don't think China wants to rule North Korea. But I do think that China wants to do everything it can to avoid destabilizing influences on its border. And so, again, this is something that I think you're going to have to watch very closely. As I said just a minute ago, you know, as much as China may want to do that, I think that we probably overstate their actual influence in terms of their ability to affect day-to-day decision-making on the ground. In the end, you know, while things are marginal, Chinese influence and role and support can help prop up the regime. The decision by the Chinese leadership to very early on basically endorse Kim Jong-un in this succession is a very important early factor that will lead to early stability. But if things really begin to fall apart, I think there's almost no amount of Chinese intervention that would actually be able to reverse that process.
A final question on the pace of talks that were otherwise progressing. There had been some progress or suggestion that there would be some resumption on the denuclearization talks and the six-party process. Reports of 240,000 tons of U.S. foodstuffs in exchange for North Korean acquiescence and giving up some highly enriched uranium processing capabilities, and also progress in terms of the return of war remains. Is all this on hold then, or are there opportunities, given some of the earlier comments, that we should be seizing upon?
Stephen, this is Tom. I just want to go back to my earlier experience with the aftermath of Kim Il-sung's death. I think, you know, we all need to be thinking strategically and conceptually, but actual experience sometimes is important. And I found that the North Koreans were far more ready, more quickly than I expected, to resume their talks with us, which were in a fairly positive mode at the time of Kim Il-sung's death, and things I've seen in the press this morning suggesting that the U.S. and North Koreans have had a talk in New York and they're talking about resuming these food aid talks, to me are encouraging.
Very good. Thank you. And now I'd like the opportunity for each of our contributors to offer any final thoughts. Charles, would you like to begin?
Well, we are still obviously in very early days of this transition. My own feeling is that the short term will be stable, things will go as planned, and that the status quo will prevail. I think over the long run, there are a number of perhaps significant changes that could take place, that may be positive, but also possibly very troubling. So I think we have to see things continuing on pretty stably for the next several months, and see what kind of a North Korea we'll be dealing with 5-6 months down the road.
Gordon?
Yeah, I would 100% agree with what Charles had just said in terms of my basic prognosis. And you know, recognizing that there's not an awful lot that we can do externally that's going to directly influence that, you know, I think that we ought to work as carefully as we can with our allies and communicate as close as we can with our other partners in the region to ensure that no matter what direction this goes, be it a positive direction, be it a return to six-party talks, be it some type of a instability or military conflagration, that we don't allow the develops in North Korea to drive our agenda in the region or to kind of impact what our core national interests are in the region. And that really is in the broader economic progress, peace, and stability of the region. So, again, you know, these are fascinating developments and fascinating times, but we need to make sure that we step back and keep perspective in terms of where our strategic interests lie.
John?
Yes, two quick things. One is I think we're all in agreement that we have just entered into the fog of the post-Kim Jong-il period. And with this fog, I think the only things that we can do at this particular point in time is to really promote this idea of clear and regular communication among all of the leaders concerned. This has to be done at the top level. It's encouraging that the foreign ministers have done it to a certain extent, but this has to start as a practice and a behavior at the leadership level, because as we enter into 2012, we'll have a change of leadership. I think it's better to have this type of practice and behavior in place as we go through the leadership changes in other countries. The second point is, I would echo what Gordon was saying before, that the Chinese are terrified. I don't mean to give this impression that the Chinese are doing what they're doing is with tremendous confidence. If anything, if we recollect to what happened with the financial crisis in the United States, the fear and the uncertainty that was bred by the concept of too big to fail, I think that captures to a certain extent how the Chinese view North Korea. And one of the ways we can better understand why the Chinese are doing a lot of things that go above and beyond what we'd expect of China. But again, this is something that doesn't go and impact day-to-day decision-making in China and North Korea, but certainly it is something that the Chinese have prioritized. And we'll see more of that as senior Chinese officials are going to be involved in the period, in the mourning process, as well as what comes after in terms of trying to help out the collective leadership in North Korea.
Thank you. Tom?
Well, just in conclusion, I'd like to say that this is very rare, but I agree with literally everything that was said by everybody in this conversation this morning, and I'd like to thank our distinguished guests for joining us in this discussion. I think my final note is that one thing that is really very different from what we saw in 1994 is the absolutely close relationship between the United States and South Korea. And on this issue, I think absolute agreement with our other important ally, Japan, as well. There will be a fairly early event on the Korean Peninsula, that is the March Nuclear Security Summit, when President Obama and President Lee, and I assume Prime Minister Noda, will have a chance to get together and on the Korean Peninsula and South Korea, and this may be a signal event in the process. Thank you all again for joining us.
Thank you, Ambassador. And again, thank you to our contributors for what has truly been a substantive discussion. We thank you to all of those here in the room today and to our team here led by Nikita Desai. And thank you to you, the podcast listener. Please join us Friday, January 20th at 8:30 a.m., where we will have a discussion of the Seoul Nuclear Security Summit 2012 in advance of the March summit just mentioned by Ambassador Hubbard. And further discussion on these topics will arise over the course of coming months in our Knowing North Korea series here at the Korea Society. Please join us at koreasociety.org for information on these and other programs. Again, thank you.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.